It's 9 o'clock, so let us start. I want to begin first by making an addition to what I said last class. I said last class that I thought that the Brisker Rav made his way to Eretz Yisrael through Turkey. That is correct, but before he got to Turkey, he actually left from Odessa, and he even left together with Reb Lezer Yudofinkel of the Mir Yeshiva. They both went from Odessa. They had the ability to leave Vilna. They went to Odessa, and from Odessa, then they went to Turkey, and from there to the land of Israel. So let me put that down. I want to begin with just where we left off, and I want to share with you some things about Rav Aaron Cutler and Vahid Hatzolah. I really could spend the whole hour on this, but I'm not going to. Just briefly, I want to say and repeat what I said last class, how involved he was in rescue in Vahid Hatzolah. In Irving Bunim's book, or the book about Irving Bunim, Bunim's book, he has a great deal about this. For example, on page 144 and on, he has an unbelievable story of how Rav Aaron went with Bunim to meet with who was for money. See, the United States government was not going to allow that, but they were trying to find ways to permit it by saying that the money is not ransom, the money is used to pay for the transportation of the Jews or the food from the Jews that would be let out, that sort of thing. And the story is that how Rav Aaron was very strong with Morgenthau, got Morgenthau even to state, this is Henry Morgenthau, that that he would sooner give up his job and even his life, you know, if he could speak, if he could help his people. I don't know if anything came of this really. He discusses this in the book, but I mean, it's quite interesting. And anyone who wants to learn more about Hatzolah in the war. And it's a tough thing because obviously you want to save everyone you can. And if you could ransom, and that's what it was, if you could ransom Jews, if you could pay Himmler money to free Jews, you want to do that. And on the other hand, you can also understand how the United States government can't allow people to give money to the country that the United States is fighting against. Not only was it against the law, you can only imagine what the anti-Semitism would have been created if. You know, here you have Jews giving money to the Germans so they could then buy weapons to kill Americans. Now, in order to forestall this, the Nazis actually said that any money they received would only be used on the Eastern Front. But it was a non-starter from the beginning. But if you read Bunim's book, they actually found a way through Morgenthau and the War Refugee Board to allow monies to go to Switzerland, knowing that this money would then go to the Germans. But at least at one time, they thought that this was important, and $937,000 were actually authorized by the Treasury Department to go to Switzerland. So very interesting. In Sorosky's book, on page, let me put this down here. In Sorosky's book on page 347, he has a list of students from Kletsk Yeshiva, almost 200, approximately 200 names of rebbes and students and teachers who were killed in the Holocaust because they didn't get out. And at the end of the day, there's no denying the fact that although people like Rav Aaron stayed, I mean, people like Rav Aaron stayed till the end, and many others did, when it was really too late, it is true, as has been alleged, but it is true, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, that the leadership of all the yeshivas, they were the ones who got out. They were the ones, not all of them got out, not of them, all of them tried to get out. Not all of them even realized they could get out till it was too late, but the ones who made an effort to get out, for the most part, they did get out. And that's because they were important. at the end of the day, if this is the land of Israel, if it's America, if it's any organization in these countries and they have visas, let's say if I have visas for 500 people or 300 people, rather than giving it to someone I don't know, or rather just letting them loose, I'm obviously going to rescue people who I know, either family members, either members of my organization, or great rabbis. If I have a couple hundred certificates, or if I only have 20 certificates, I don't. Who do I know in Europe? If you're not dealing with family members, I know of great rabbis. So it is. I mean, how did the Brisker Rav get out of Vilna? How did Rav Zvi Finkel get out of Vilna? And other people were not able to get out. It's because they had people on the outside, the Jewish agency in particular, who was willing to give them the visas. And unfortunately, many others remained, especially for the Kletzky Yeshiva and the other yeshivas, because they never took advantage. They were all willing and wanted to go to the land of Israel, but they were not willing to take advantage of the Sugi Hara visas. Only the Mir Yeshiva did it as a group, whereas other yeshivas was only individuals. And because of that, unfortunately, when things turned, when the Germany invaded Lithuania, something no one could have imagined, because let's recall that there was a treaty between the Soviets and Germany, and the Soviets were in control of Lithuania. And while the Soviets were in control of Lithuania at this time, if you had a visa, you were permitted to leave and exit through the Soviet Union. So there would be no reason to assume that people couldn't wait until they'd be able to get their exit permit and entry visa to go to either to America, Canada, or the land of Israel. But unfortunately, as we know, once the Germans moved in, then it was impossible to leave. And again, talk about important people, only someone like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was able to be removed from Poland and allowed to leave, or the other stories you might have heard, the Gera Rebbe, these were special people who, bribery and you know, other actions, allowed them to leave. In the other book I mentioned, Udim Me'esh, page 45 and on, you also have a list of students. This is a letter that Rav Aharon wrote to the Jewish agency listing the names of over 200 students, probably some teachers here as well, with their birthplace, hoping that they could get out. This letter was written in the spring of 1940. You know, we talk a lot about how the Jews wanted to leave, but the gates were shut. That is true, the gates were shut. Were they being killed at this moment, I'd like to think that the British would be, not just the British, the Americans would have been more generous in opening up the gates. But in March 1940, in Vilna, Jews were not being killed, and therefore the British could claim that there's no emergencies here, there's no reason why we need to raise the quota. We all know that the white paper in the 30s, after the Arabs made problems for the British shut down the immigration. They were very concerned about oil and their influence in the region. So when things turned really bad, they couldn't get out. I only want to say, though, again, that there were opportunities to leave. They could have gone to places like South America. They could have gone to places, Mozambique. I think 100,000 refugees they offered to take, as I mentioned already. There were other places they could have gone, but no one's a prophet. In 1938, 1937, Jews could have left Poland also, but who knew? So I mention this only because the rabbis get such criticism for not telling the people to leave, but it's not just the rabbis. No one had any inkling of what was coming. So I think it's unfair. And let me just quote, there's an article that appeared in Tablet Magazine a few years ago by someone in the Lakewood Yeshiva. He works there, he's an archivist. His name is Rakov, and he wrote about the Lakewood Yeshiva and Rav Aharon, and he says as follows, Rabbi Cutler fully understood the enormity of the Holocaust on a personal level. He lost family members. His son, recently engaged, had to escape to Israel. He means Palestine, or Eretz Israel, while his fiancée escaped to Shanghai, only married 9 years later. Most of his 300 students trapped behind in Europe perished in the Holocaust despite his best efforts to save them. Of course, Varhaftig would say it wasn't his best efforts. His best efforts would have been had he agreed that they should go to Shanghai, or had he agreed before 1940 to allow yeshiva students to take permits to travel to the land of Israel. But again, this is a Monday morning quarterbacking. So let us now return. I'll get to the questions and comments later, at the end. Let us now return to America. Let's leave von Hatzala, although throughout the 40s until the end of the war, he was very involved in that. Before Lakewood, there was an attempt to establish a base medrash. It was more than an attempt. They actually did, really a kollel in White Plains, New York. And they asked Rav Aharon to head this kollel. But he refused to head it because he was so busy with Vat Hatzalah. When I say busy with Vat Hatzalah, I mean raising money. I mean going to Washington, speaking to important people. But they were able to convince Rav Aharon that he should be involved with it by saying that he would give a shiur, say a shiur, but have no financial responsibilities. However, that was short-lived because in 1943, Rav Aharon announces his intention to open a yeshiva to be named Beis Medrash Gavoa. I'm not sure why they didn't call it, I forget, the Chetz Keshiva was Eitz Chaim, as I recall. Why they didn't call it that, or why they didn't call it, have the name Kletzk, because at the end of the day, Kletzk, the yeshiva, finds its continuity in Lakewood. Lakewood is Kletzk, which is Slutsk. It's the same thing, I'm assuming, at least the same Rosh Yeshiva, but they called it Beis Medrash Gavoa. And that's how it's called from the beginning, if you look in the English, and if you go to the, I can't say go to their website, but go look at the building, the stationery. It's spelled Govoha, and which is itself worth noting because that's not how you pronounce it in Hebrew. I don't know how good Ashkenazim are in Diktuk, but the word Gavoha should not be Gavoha, it's Gavoha. It's what they call a Patach Kanuva, or a furtive Patach. It's just like in the word Noach. You don't say Nocha, you say Noach. And it's the same thing with the word. It's not Gavoha, it's Gavoha. In any event, it's called Beis Medrash Gavoha. Now, why Lakewood? What's so special about Lakewood? Well, as we said last class, hold on a second. Wrong one. Okay, this is someone I'm going to be getting to. I don't know if anyone recognizes who it is, but... I will get to him later. Yes, Meiselman, correct. Herman Wouk at age 102. You'll see why I get to him later. This is a recent picture of him. Baruch Hashem, he's still going strong. But that's not what I meant to bring down. I meant to bring down, here he is. This is it. Here's the picture, Rabbi Waxman on the right with Rav Herzog. And Rabbi Nissen Waxman, the father of Chaim Waxman, he was the Rav of the town of Lakewood. Lakewood was a town. It had a number of resorts there where people would come. And it was he who had been a student. I forgot to mention something. I said that he was the representative of the Mir Yeshiva when Kletzk was opened. And he also had been a student in Slobodka. But what I forgot to mention is that he was also a student in Kletzk. And he knew Rav Aharon. So he was the one who convinced Rav Aharon to come there. And incidentally, before they established the yeshiva in Lakewood, that is Rav Aharon's yeshiva, there was an attempt to establish the Lumja yeshiva in Lakewood, but nothing came of it. So Rav Aharon, sort of Rabbi Waxman, said to Rav Aharon, come to Lakewood, and because they had already done all the arrangements and everything to have a yeshiva, a Lumja yeshiva, they can have a Lakewood yeshiva. There's a very interesting book published in 1982, which is really before the great flowering of the yeshivas, but it was just beginning. It's called by William Helmreich, called The World of the Yeshiva, An Intimate Portrait of Orthodox Jewry. And on page 42, it talks about Lakewood, and it quotes Irving Bunim, that Lakewood was an ideal place. So, first of all, it's not in the city. And that's important. Rav Aharon never wanted to be in the city. He didn't want to be in Vilna. because of the distractions. He didn't want to be in New York. He didn't even want to be in White Plains, which is close to New York. He wanted to go out into the sticks a bit. Now, it was also, they don't mention it here. Bunim says what was needed was a small city without nightclubs, without entertainment. And Bunim was involved in raising the money to buy the house where it first began. What they don't mention here is, however, the fact that it was a vacation community was important because a lot of wealthy people would go there in the summer, and that was a way to raise money. I don't even know. I know we have Moshe from Lakewood here. Is how far is that? I mean, there's no. Maybe there are there any lakes in Lakewood? Where do they have these resorts? It was just a way to get out of the hot sun and everything. It's not that far from the shore, but it's not Deal or anything. But in the Lakewood area, they had these resorts. So Moshe says he had man-made lakes, so they would swim, I guess, and do other things like that. And that was a place to raise money. He also quotes Waxman, that is Helmreich quotes Waxman, how he was able to persuade Revarum. And the yeshiva opens in 1943 with 14 students. And some of the students came from the Kollel in White Plains, which really, if you, the first Kollel in America is the Kollel in White Plains. I don't know if this is well known, but that is the first Kollel in America. And it's fitting that Revarum was involved with it because the whole philosophy of Kollel that we're going to speak about is really Revarum's invention. He created this idea. It would have been unimaginable before Revarum. Others came from Torah Vadas. I have the names of all the students. For these 14 students, those who've taken class previous with me, it might remind you of remember the famous 14 students of Sutsk, the so-called Yad HaChazaka, Yud Daled 14. The difference is of the Yad HaChazaka, I mean, some of these are the 14 of Sutsk, Eliezer Finkel, Yosef Konvitz, Pesach Pruskin, Reuven Katz. Some of them, at least, became real Gedolei Yisro, important figures. I don't know if any of, I'll read you the names of the 14 of who started Lakewood. Some of them did become significant figures, but I don't think anyone would regard them as Gedolim in the sense as I just read you the names. But let me read you the names. Some of them I never heard of. Some of them are pretty well known, but again, not at the level of the 14 of Slutsk, not by far. I just read you, Eliezer Finkel, Reuven Katz. I mean, these are Gedolei Yisrael. Here are the names. Rav Yisrael Kanarik. I don't know him, but I know Kanarik's. Rav Simcha Lezissa Leibovitz. Rabbi Asher Katz. Rav Mordechai Yaffe. Of these four, I don't know anything about. The fifth is Rav Nosson Meir Vachtfogel. He's famous because he then became the Mashgiach of the spiritual Mashgiach in the Lakewood Yeshiva. He actually comes from Rabbi Yeshiva Yitzchak Hanun. But this is before it was Yeshiva College, when it was just a high school and a place where you could learn for smicha or just to learn. When it instituted secular studies, Rabbi Wachtfogel and some other people organized a protest. So it's not right when people like to point to those people who were students at Yeshiva. They say YU, but it really was Yeshiva College. They point to Rabbi Gifter, others. It doesn't really apply to Rabbi Wachtfogel because he was not there when it was a college. But he becomes very important, and I'll mention him a little later on. Yitzhak Hoffman, Shmuel Scheinberg, Pesach Cohen, Zvi Genauer. That name rang a bell because Genauer family is an important Seattle family. So I looked up Zvi Genauer, who was he? And lo and behold, although he was studying in Lakewood, he must have had a great love of Eretz Yisrael because as soon as the State of Israel was formed, he goes to the State of Israel to learn. And he was killed by an Arab terrorist in Israel in 1954. All you have to do is Google his name and it'll come up because he might have been the first American, and he's killed with his niece. He might have been the first American ever killed by a terrorist in the state of Israel. We know about what happened in Hebron, where the terrorists killed, but that was pre-state. he might be the first American killed. I don't know about that, but he's the first American I know of who was killed by an Arab terrorist. And his family to this day lives in Seattle. If you know the name Eli Gennauer, who's written on the Sfarim blog and other places, he knows a lot about Jewish books. So that's his family. And the other names are Yisrael Bergstein, Moshe Eisenman, Zvi Kaplan, Leibola Isby, and Yaakov Weisberg, who he I've heard of. I haven't heard of the others. Maybe some, well, I'll get to the questions and comments. Maybe some of you recognize these names. By establishing this yeshiva, I mean, there were other yeshivas in America, but Rav Aharon was going to be different. And he showed his differences from the beginning in that he opposed college. The standard approach, even of the so-called Haredi yeshivas, but they weren't called Haredi then, the ones who had a different perspective than yeshiva college, yeshiva university, was that, and when I was young, this was still the approach. Maybe it is still today that places like Chaim Berlin, Meir, Torah Vadas, they all went to college at night. That was the approach. You learned during the day and you went to college at night. However, that was not Rav Aharon's approach. In Sorosky, on page 416, he tells a story. He tells how, that's a story, it's a, how you had a lot of mothers who didn't want their sons to learn in Lakewood because they figured, what's going to be about a career? What's going to be about college? And what Rav Aharon would tell them was to agree to let their son remain there 1 year. And once, what happened often was once the son was there for 1 year, then he himself imbibed the philosophy of Lakewood, and he himself no longer wanted to go to university. They also tell the story about a certain famous American Rosh Yeshiva. In all the examples that Sorosky gives, he never identifies who these individuals are, but in one case, which I'll read to you later, I have no doubt I figured out who it is. But a famous American Rosh Yeshiva who came to Rav Aharon and said, "Give me back my son," because he didn't want him to only learn. He wanted him also to go to college. I guess it wouldn't be too difficult to figure out which great Rosh Yeshiva's son learned in Lakewood. Maybe thinking Kamenetsky, Rebecca Kamenetsky and his son, Shmuel Kamenetsky, but I can't imagine that Yaakov Kamenetsky would have wanted his son to only, not to only learn Torah, that is to go to college. I never thought of Yaakov as thinking that, and I don't think he would. But maybe we could figure it out. And so you see that it's it wasn't only the masses that Rav Aharon has to change their mind, as we'll see, it's also the rabbis. He has another passage. This is found on in Sorosky on page volume 2, page 148, where he quotes here Rav Aharon's argument that at the end of the day, how can someone become a brisker rav, he says, if you go to college? How can you become a chasam sofer if you're spending half the day or a quarter of the day or anything when you're not devoted entirely to Torah study? What are you going to do? But that's only one aspect of the problem. Before I go on and tell you about the other aspect, I want to share with you something Rabbi Wachtfogel said. And this is quoted in Musrei Kletz, pages 51, 52. Rabbi Wachtfogel recalls as follows, that once at an Agudas Rabbanim meeting, a Suda Shlishis in Yeshiva, Agudas Rabbanim had a, they spent a Shabbos in the yeshiva, and one of the rabbis, he just says, an important rabbi, said in his Dvar Torah or speech that the yeshivas Eitz Chaim needs the Rosh Yeshiva in Israel. And upon hearing this, Rav Aharon said to Rabbi Wachtfogel, "You see, they want to get rid of me because they thought that they're, you know, there's trouble, that Rav Aharon's causing trouble." And then he tells that Rav Aharon had to, you know, when he first started the yeshiva, he had to go to try to find Bachrim from this place to that place. And Wachtfogel says that I suggested a few times to Rav Aharon, let's make a high school. Makes perfect sense. You have a high school, The guys are going to the high school, and naturally they would remain in Lakewood in the yeshiva after they finished with the Lakewood high school. And that's what you had in Terva Das, and you had in Mir, and you had in Chaim Berlin. And what did Rav Aaron answer him? And Rav Aaron, he says, well, no, Rav Aaron never would answer him. And then he said, the Rebbetzin told me that the reason he didn't agree to a high school was because he wanted to have at least one corner in America, which is, as it says, Shem and Tahor, that is pure. If you have a high school, you have to teach them secular subjects. He wanted to have a place where it's just Torah. Why he didn't himself tell Wachtfogel this reason, I don't know. But this comes from the Rebbetzin. So Rav Aaron, though, had no complaints, publicly at least, against that I know of, against the high schools of the other yeshivas. He would have complaints about what Ner Yisrael was doing, but that's post-high school. However, in the 1950s, there was a plan before I go on, let me say a few more things about the plan from the 1950s. Unlike the other yeshivot, once you enrolled in Lakewood, it was forbidden for you to go to the university. It might even to this day, we have someone from Lakewood listening to us now, it might even be forbidden at present if you're in Lakewood. I'm not sure. I do know someone who was learning in Lakewood, and secretly he went to one of the local colleges and he did all his biology stuff, and he was then able to go to medical school. And now, of course, they give him kavod. I also know someone who got a, because he needed it to do weddings, to be shown that he's a clergyman, that he got a certificate, like a BTL certificate. And Lakewood issues BTLs. You have people in Harvard Law School now. Recently, Columbia always did it, but recently Harvard has agreed to take this, the BTL, Bachelor of Talmudic Law, for law school. So you have these brilliant people. I mean, the average person couldn't do it, but brilliant people who never had a real, never went to college, just autodidactic, they're able to do very well on the LSATs. And based on that, they can get into Harvard. This was arranged, incidentally, by Noah Feldman, the infamous Noah Feldman, who in recent years, I think, I'm not going to be cynical, I'm going to say, I assume he saw the error of his ways and is trying to rebuild his reputation in the Jewish world. And he's opened up an Institute of Jewish Law in Harvard. He wrote that fluff piece, I think it was in Tablet, about Lakewood. And he's responsible for changing the policy so that Lakewood now brings in, that Harvard now has BTLs. And he even has a seminar where he studies texts and things with the Harvard students once a week. So that's Noah Feldman. I had to deal with the BTL because at the University of Scranton, I had a student from the Scranton Yeshiva who had studied, not student, or, no, I think it was someone, yeah, he was in Beis Medrash, but he wanted to get a degree in the education school because I guess he thought it would help him in as a principal of a day school. So I wanted to take education courses at the University of Scranton, and he presented them with the BTL, and I was called by the admissions people because they said that he has a degree from this place, Beth Medrash Gavoha. And the head of admission said to me, but I don't know anything about this place. It's not an accredited university. And I had to explain to them that it's not a university at all. It's not. My recommendation was they allow the person in as on probation, basically, to see if he could handle it. Because at the end of the day, the BTL doesn't mean anything. It's not like they took an LSATs or anything. The courses would have required research and writing of papers and things like that. And it could be the man could do it perfectly. But it could be that he didn't have a clue. I had to explain to the head of admissions that that this person has never written term papers, has never done college-type work, and that if he is an intelligent person and is a good reader, then he won't have a problem at all because he's probably very smart. On the other hand, I said, you can't assume that. In the end, he never came. I'm not sure why. But as I said, my recommendation was to allow him in. And see if he knows what a college, what a graduate class is like, and I always assumed he'd be able to handle it. Now, as mentioned already a number of times, this philosophy, this approach of Rivarone, is not just Lakewood. It is very important, of course, but it's the yeshivas that came out of Lakewood. Think about Toronto, Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, Stanford, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Scranton, Mexico, all these places, Europe and Latin America. Rav Aaron created the model of the yeshiva bachur that we think of today, where it's kulo Torah. It's true he wasn't the only one. In the Tel's yeshiva, they also had the exact same philosophy, but I don't think anyone can look around America today and say that the reason American Orthodoxy and the influence of right-wing Orthodoxy is because of Tel's. Do Tel's have any influence? And if you look around, we'll go to Tel's today, they say the place is nothing. It's falling apart. There's nothing there. It's Lakewood. It all comes out of Lakewood. And he created this model. And I'll read you something that Rabbi Wachtfogel said in a little bit. But you have to give Rav Aaron the credit for this, for changing the trend in America, the tide, for what it means to be a Haredi yeshiva. Very interesting, however, is that in addition to opposing university, basically for everyone, certainly for yeshiva students, however, if someone couldn't fit in the yeshiva world, I shouldn't say for everyone, for men, as we know, his own daughter went to the university. Girls was always different, even in Lithuania. But you know, if someone had to go to the university or something, I don't think Rav Aaron would protest too much if he wasn't a yeshiva student and he wasn't really in part of his community. However, Rav Aaron was asked a question in which he did protest. And this is a tshuva which I don't even know if it was published in any of his writings, but it's found in the journal Arita, volume 17. And or by now they, I'll check. By now it's probably in Mishnah Sarvaron. The question is as follows: is it permissible lilmod b'college to go study in a college hashayach l'dat romi, limudei philosophos sociaga va'od? Can you study in a Catholic university? So we already know that you can't study in a regular university, but maybe there's certain exceptions. Extreme circumstances. Here, Rav Aaron was asked specifically about going to a Catholic university. Now, before I give you what Rav Aaron says, I have to tell you that Rav Moshe Feinstein held not only is it permissible, it's better to go to a Catholic university. He wrote this, said this in, I think it was the 60s. He thought that a Catholic university, there was less problems with SNEOS. Some Catholic universities were single sex, but even he thought that there were less problems with SNEOS and they had more respect for religion. So that was Rav Aaron's position. It's mentioned in the Masoras Moshe. However, Rav Aaron has an exactly opposite position. And he talks about how, and this is from 1953. He says that in the rooms, there are Basile Avodah Zarah, that means crucifixes. I don't know why that should be an issue. The local hospital near me is a Catholic hospital. There are many hospitals. Gam mitpalim kama pamim bayom lifnei ahar tzelto acharein. Also, they pray before the lectures and after them. He's talking about, he's saying philosophy, sociology. I don't know who was feeding him this information. I've been teaching at a Catholic university for 21 years. My father taught at a Catholic university all the time I've been been around. Seton Hall University. From 1969, and before that he was teaching in St. John's. My father went to Georgetown. They've never had prayers before any philosophy classes, before any sociology classes. Theology classes, in my university, there is one professor I know of where they do a little prayer, because that's like the religious thing. These universities, Catholic universities, they're philosophy professors. Half of them are not Catholic, they're atheists. So I don't know who was feeding, and this is even in the 1950s, they didn't have prayers before classes like this. I don't know who was feeding him this information. And then he says it's therefore forbidden to step foot in there because you might be led astray by their prayers and the Avodah Zarah, etc., etc. And then he goes on to talk about the heresy that they study there. I can tell you that despite the strong response of here, which to be true, sure, was not published, to be fair, I should say, only was published, I think, 15 years ago, but his opinion must have been known. I don't know if anyone had held to this opinion. If you go to Fordham, which is a Catholic university, the law school is full of yeshivish people there. I teach in Scranton. Scranton's a Catholic university. There's also a university called Marywood in Scranton, which is also a Catholic university. Without getting into details, I can only just say that there have been people very involved in the Scranton yeshiva, let's leave it at this, whose own children have attended Marywood University. Perhaps even Scranton. There's definitely been Orthodox Jews from the community taking classes in Scranton, but one person in particular attended Marywood University. That's a man. Women, I think there's been a bunch of them have gone to Marywood. So the idea that that Catholic universities are any different, you go to the Catholic university, it's no different than any other university. It's true that you have to take a theology course. When my father that went to Georgetown, and this is back into the late 50s, as a Jew, he was exempted from it. University of Scranton, the Orthodox kid who went there was also exempted from it, from taking the theology class, two theology classes he had to take. So I haven't seen any evidence that Catholic universities are regarded as any more problematic than non-Catholic universities. As I mentioned, Rav Moshe Feinstein thought it was actually, it was a mila because they take, because he says that tzniut, and I think he also might have mentioned that they take religion more seriously, but I can't remember the second part. Since I mentioned it, though, the Stipler, in his volume of letters, volume 1, number 50, he also says, Uvidvar ha-kolod shel ha-komrim, if you ask me about the college of the priests, mazo sheila, what's the question? Halo hubi yaharig v'yavar. It's yaharig v'yavar, because of the Avodah Zarah. Again, it's... they've never been to a Catholic university, and they think that somehow a Catholic university is like Catholic school where you're indoctrinated, where it's not that at all. And as I mentioned before, the BTLs, all you have to do is go to Fordham. I saw it myself because I gave a lecture once in Fordham, and a lot of the BTLs go to Fordham, which not only is a Catholic university, you have at least one priest teaching, or he taught in the law school. And take my word for it, he didn't have everyone stand up and say a prayer before he taught. In my university, we have a priest in the mathematics department, Jesuits. My university is Jesuit, as is Fordham, and the priests teach in all sorts of different departments. So let us return. An important point about his yeshiva was indeed the kol. Rav Aaron thought, and he again has to be given the credit for this, that everyone has to learn for in kolel for at least a few years after marriage. And when we speak about kolel, we're talking about kolel in Lakewood, not about the Kiruv kolels. You know, that's a new phenomenon. I have no idea whether Rav Aaron would have approved of that. Rav Shach did not approve of that for top students. Although today it's become a thing, it's like basic to the kolel philosophy. That was not the philosophy when it first began. The kolel was a place where people can learn undisturbed, and that's really where you can, for no purpose other than learning the Torah, and that's where you can expand your horizons in all different areas of Torah. Now, this was an innovation. There was a kolel in Kovno, maybe even Aishashak, if you want to call it a kolel, but that was for exceptional people. Rav Aaron, however, thought that the kolel should be for everyone. Anyone who studied in yeshiva, and in his opinion, everyone studying in yeshiva, should also go to kolel. Now, that doesn't mean, he's not talking like in Israel, where the idea was that everyone stays in kolel forever. He didn't say that at all. Of course, you have to go out and make a living somehow. If the money existed for everyone, then that would be one thing, but it doesn't. But everyone should go to kolel for a few years, and then afterwards, you go be a Rebbe, you do something else. And the exceptional people, they would remain forever until they become Rosh Yeshiva. But this is a new concept, the idea that everyone stays in kolel. And it's pretty standard today in the Haredi world. And that's You have to give Reviron credit for that. Rabbi Wachtfogel says something else of interest. It's an article he wrote, which is published in Musrei Kletz, and I agree with what he says. Before he says as follows: before Rav Aharon came to America, there were yeshivas in America. Aval ben Torah lo haya, but you didn't have the concept of a ben Torah, where one's whole life is focused on Torah. Yes, there were people who studied. But they all also had a, they all were going to university. They had a focus also on a career. So they studied in yeshiva for a few years till they moved on to their career. And I'm sure most of the people listening know people who studied in Chaim Berlin and Torah Vadas, and they became very good balabatim, very impressive balabatim, balabatim who can learn, who appreciate a good shiur. That's not what you get out of most people who go to YU, just go to 4 years of college and then, you know, go out and get a job. I know many of these people. And these are people who any rabbi wants to have as a balabas, one who really appreciates learning and can learn on his own. But they were not ben Torah in the sense that we think of today. They're pious balabatim and learned balabatim, more learned than you ever had in Europe. So on the one hand, that's a great thing, but Rav Aharon wanted more. And he goes on... Rabbi Wachtfogel elaborating on this. One more passage I'll read to you from him. Is this it? No, I don't see it, but he basically said, oh, here it is. Too many papers here. On page 54, let me try, I'll translate it for you. People do not appreciate enough the revolution that Rav Aharon created. He turned everything over. He changed the Mahalach HaMachshava, the way of thinking. Today, everyone understands, even the weak people, that it's important to continue to learn Torah. Zepashut, this is obvious. That is, continue in Kolol. Aval Pam, Shum Davar Lo Yapashut. But things were not so simple. Until Rabbi Aharon came to America, there were in America many balabatim yireim v'shleimim, many religious balabatim, oskim mitzvos, they who followed mitzvos, v'gam kavuitim v'torah, and also set aside time for Torah. They would, and they didn't have, in those days, you didn't have TV. What did people do? They'd go to the shul, they'd hear a shir in Yaakov, on Mishnah, or something like that. Avon lo hayas shum musag shel kavod ha-Torah. But there was no concept of kavod ha-Torah, he's saying. Or then he goes on, there's no musag to be a ben Torah. All they knew was that you had to be an erecher balabas, which is what I said. You had to be an erecher, a religious balabas, one who respects rabbis, respects learning. But it was Rav Aharon who created the concept of the Ben Torah. And I think what Rav Wachtfogel said is 100% correct. If you're a Hirschian, then you don't see this as a good thing, because your whole concept as a Hirschian would be that the concept of Ben Torah is an elitist thing, which should only be for rabbis and certain special individuals. But it's precisely the Erech HaBalabas community that we should strive to create, and which was created in Frankfurt. But Rav Aharon had a different perspective. And with all the good, there is bad, because anyone who knows about that world knows that there are people who fall through the cracks. Rav Aharon, although the yeshiva was established in Lakewood, he did not live in Lakewood. I think a lot of people don't realize this. He would come down to give his shiur, and occasionally he would come for Shabbos, but for the most part, he was in New York. He was very busy raising money for the yeshiva, as well as other things. He had an apartment in Lakewood in the dormitory. People speak about him, and they identify him with the yeshiva and his great impact and his great influence, and that's where most of the influence comes from. But at the time, he was also involved in something else which had a great impact, and that's this organization called Torah Umasora, which is devoted, which was devoted, still is, to elementary school education. When it came to elementary school, Rav Aharon had a different perspective when it came to secular studies. Although it is due to his influence that the ideal of the yeshiva in the day and college at night fell out of favor, And even due to his influence, that day schools changed. In his day, whereas he was strong in his opposition to college and secular studies, he did not have this opposition to the day schools. In fact, Helmreich tells a very interesting story. Which illustrates how so much he was opposed to the college, to secular studies at the yeshiva level, but not for day schools. I'll give you another story in a minute, which shows you how tolerant and you might say liberal he was when it came to secular studies in the day schools. Helmreich, the story's been told many places, but I think the first person to tell it is Helmreich, and this is on page 46 and on in his book, World of the Yeshiva. Conclusion was reached by Rabbi Huttner and Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelwitz and other important people that, you know, at the university there are temptations, there's non-religious people there, there's non-religious teachers, so why not create a, basically a lander college? The problem with yeshivas or Bitzel Chanon is they have a humanities curriculum, but not everyone wants humanities. So to create a, it was supposed to be called American Theological University. It even was given the charter by the state of New York, and there's to be secular courses, I'm reading, quoting now, psychology, chemistry, mathematics, and so on. That is the non-objectionable sorts. I mean, psychology is an interesting one because in a sense, it could be very objectionable with Freudian ideas, but I assume they would have cautioned them out. If you think about Lander College, you get the idea. They wanted to have three schools, a school of theology, where you get a doctor of theology degree or a PhD. You can get, I think, a doctoral degree in Lakewood, in Baltimore. You know, it's not the PhD like you have in the secular universities, but it would be a serious research project, and I don't know if a two-year course of study in Jewish theology means just sitting and learning for 2 years, or it actually is broader. Then there'd be a school of social studies, so community problems, an MA degree, basically Jewish communal service, and then there's a school of administration, where to become a Jewish, to become, get given a degree in educational leadership, to lead schools, etc. Who was supposed to be in charge of it? Or actually, I should say, who was the originator of the idea? Who then, I don't know if he was going to be in charge. It was, his name was Rabbi Harold Lyman, the father of the famous Schneer Lyman, who at this time was principal of the Chaim Berlin Yeshiva. They said, as part of the plan, was that they were going to have regular college courses, but the courses would be offered by Orthodox Jews. I don't know if that ever would have been able to continue. In America, I don't even know if it's legal anymore, but even Lander College, you'll have non-Jews teaching. What I don't know if they have at Lander is non-Orthodox Jews. I don't know if that's... In Germany, in Hirsch's school, Hirsch insisted that for the secular subjects, either Orthodox Jews or non-Jews, because of the fear that non-Orthodox Jews could be a bad role model or could spread non-religious ideas. So that was the plan. And what happened? And they, as I said, they were given this provisional charter in 1946. And then a year later, the charter is withdrawn. And what was the reason? Rabbi Lyman explained that what it says here in the book is that after a long discussion between Rabbi Mendelwitz and Rabbi Cutler, in which Rabbi Cutler expressed a strong opposition, the plan was shelved. That's the story, and that's the story I always heard, that Rav Aaron reacted very strongly to this idea, which he thought would be an adulteration of the integrity and the purity of the yeshivas. It's one thing if the guys go to college at night, that's sort of on their own, but to actually have it as part of the yeshiva, he objected very strongly to Neir Yisroel. Was completely opposed to that philosophy because that was an official involvement between the university and the yeshiva, which they were giving credits, and that he thought was absolutely forbidden. In those days, it was Johns Hopkins, and now it's Townsend. I know at times they had agreements with Loyola. Loyola is a Catholic university, also a Jesuit university. But to open up a place like American Hebrew Theological, whatever they called it, the American Hebrew Theological University, that Rav Aharon said is destroying what it is to be yeshiva. Now, Rav Soloveitchik, he thought just the opposite. We have him on tape where he's speaking about how great it is at YU because in the morning you're in a great yeshiva. Even exaggerates, I think. He says it's like Volozhin. He says the students we have here are just like they had in Volozhin. Maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but then he says, and then when you're finished, let's say 3 o'clock, you just go upstairs and you have the secular studies. So you have two the same thing in one building. Think of though going to if I'm learning in Mir and then I have to go to Brooklyn College, think of all the Bittul Torah, Bittul Zman. I have to walk there or go on the subway. I have to go on the subway by the time I get there. It's an hour each way, not to mention the fact that you have the girls. Granted, it's at night, so they're older, they're married, but still, there's women there. When you think about it, it makes a lot of sense to do it for a variety of reasons, to do it in one institution where you don't need to be concerned with these other things and you don't waste all that time. But Rav Aharon thought that by having it as part of the yeshiva, and there's a tradition, the Volozhin yeshiva, although it is not true that it closed down because of secular studies, and there were times where they did teach secular studies. When they finally did close down, it was because that the secular studies they wanted to enforce would have totally destroyed the yeshiva. But it wasn't that wasn't the reason. They didn't want to really. They weren't interested in secular studies. They were the Russians. They wanted to close the yeshiva down. That's why they didn't do it with any other yeshivas. I spoke about that in the past. However, in the yeshiva legend, it's always been that Volozhin closed down rather than bring in secular studies. So Rav Aharon was very strong about this. Now, if you look in Sorosky, however, he tells the story a little differently, and he quotes someone, but I don't have any reason to think that the person he's quoted has any inside knowledge. He claims that Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz turned to Rav Aharon and asked Rav Aharon his opinion. And Rav Aharon said no, and that killed it. Maybe, but I've never heard that. I've always heard it the other way, that it's Rav Aharon who he wasn't asked, but he exerted his influence, and it shows you that Rav Aharon was much more of a significant personality than Rav Huttner. And if Rav Aharon was going to go to the mat, that this is not what the yeshiva should be doing, that they couldn't go up against him. Rav Aharon was also asked about, because he was in Torah Masorah, about all sorts of questions dealing with day schools. Now, if you read Sorosky, you'll read on page 29 in volume 2 how Rav Aharon writes a very strong letter how you have to separate the boys and the girls. That you can't have day schools where the boys and girls are together in one building. The only way you can have it is if having two separate schools where they don't have any involvement with each other. Not only, even when they asked about having one building with two separate entrances, he says no. He says, b'shnei mekomot miyuchadim, you have to have two separate places. And okay, so you'll read Sorosky. And now you hear, and it makes sense from the perspective of Sorosky's writing, the idea that boys and girls will be in the same building or in the same classroom, chas v'sholem, that this isn't something unimaginable for an Israeli Haredi like Sorosky. And any of the people in Israel reading this book, it's a davar poshut. Of course, you have separate buildings, and boys and girls are not together. But this is not the whole story. This is not even half the story. I know that people in Israel, the Haredim in Israel, maybe even today Haredim in America might find it difficult to understand, but you don't need to go very far back in history. You don't even need to go very far in terms of distance today. I'm going to be in Scranton tomorrow. Scranton is a Lakewood community. The yeshiva is Lakewood. The day school is Lakewood. Boys and girls, as we speak, are in the same school, the same building, the same entrance. The classes are separated. I think they're separated from like second grade or first grade. I mean, really from early on. However, they are in the same building. I know it might be hard for a Haredi in Israel to understand this, but that's the way it is. And I'm sure it's not that way in Lakewood. But I only mention Scranton because this is a Haredi community. This is not Chaim Berlin. This is Lakewood type. And they have that. Why do they have that? Because that's the way the day school was before the Scranton people moved in. And at present, it would be impossible financially to, they have one building. They couldn't financially create a separate building. Build a separate building and have it, just it couldn't work financially, and they don't have enough students. So what did Rav Aharon say when he was asked? Reminds me, say the very same entrance. I mean, there's only one entrance to the yeshiva. I pass by it all every time I'm in Scranton. It's a day school, it's not a yeshiva. Well, let me round out the picture. Because what Sarosky leaves you with is an incorrect incorrect impression of Rav Aharon's view. Yes, Rav Aharon thought this is the way things should be. But if you read this, you assume that then he was an extremist when it came to this, and he related to this just like he related to colleges, going to college or having secular studies in the yeshiva. And it's not true at all. What I'm going to show you now shows you that Rav Aharon understood that not everything could be changed overnight, and look, he never told Chaim Berlin and the Mir they have to close down rather than let the students go to university or anything like that. He understood that things take time, and he was creating something, and it might have taken 30 years, but it happened. Let me read you some information that appears in this book, which Sarosky doesn't know, doesn't quote. I don't know if he knows English, if he would quote. And it definitely complicates matters, it has nuance to it, and is but is the truth. It's this book. Joseph Kamenetsky, Memorable Encounters, A Torah Pioneer's Glimpses of Great Men and Years of Challenge. He was the head of Torah Umesorah. Came out of Yeshiva University. Although he moved much to the right, but still he never stopped respecting Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he came out of YU, and he was very close to Rav Aharon and had many interactions with him in his dealings with Torah and Masorah. So let me tell you what he says about this very matter, because Torah and Masorah was formed to help the day schools. And in those days, even many day schools that today are separate were mixed in those days. The idea of a day school in those days was itself something you had to fight against. Many people who thought that having a day school goes against the American ideal and that we left that, in Europe. But here, Talmud Torah is enough. So the idea that they were also going to agree to separate sex schools was something that wouldn't fly in most places. Not to mention the fact that the amount of people that were available to organize a day school were often so small. They started with very small classes. If you only have six or seven in a first grade, you can't split it up into boys and girls. Financially, it doesn't make sense. And Rav Aharon understood this. However, I see it is already almost 10 o'clock, so we will start with that next class. And although on the calendar it said that next class is supposed to be the last one, I'm going to speak to Rabbi Kelman because I really need two more classes to finish. What I need to do is talk about still about Rav Aharon, certain halachic rulings of his, and then a variety of other things. About Rav Aharon, which you'll find relevant and important. And I think I might be able to do it in one class if I go late, but I'd rather do it in two classes. But we'll see. I'll speak. If not, we'll have to postpone it to a future series. So let me now take the questions, and we'll get to Hermann Wouk next class, Meiselman. Thank you for pointing him out. And wait till you hear what Rav Moshe Feinstein says about Hermann Wouk, the tzidkus, I guess you could say, about Hermann Wouk. I was a little surprised when I read that. So we'll do that next class. So let me look at answer some of the questions and comments. Meiselman has a lot to say today. Thank you. Meiselman is the primary source for the story. Bunim is a primary source for what I said about going to, because he was there with him, about going to Morgenthau. And the story with the mafia, I forget the exact story. I think it's in there as well. Moshe, you're saying about the Mishnah and Horayot, you're talking about saving people, who you save. Yes, that's if you only have enough to save someone, you have a lifeboat, and you can only save one person or two people. There's a list, and they tell you who you're supposed to save. And they do say, however, men go before women, but that's not, no one assumes that is the case today, because that's in a theoretical plane. But if someone's more of a tzaddik, that person is saved first. And the Hasidim always believed in that. But I think it's difficult today to tell people we're going to save the gedolim before anyone else. But that's exactly what happened. Meiselman says the criticism of Tress and Weiss Mandel was that although Rav Eliezer went back and saved kids, so nothing, I mean, nothing to do with precisely the opposite. Okay, I don't understand what you're saying. Oh yes, Meiselman mentions that I wrote something on a blog post about Eliezer Berkovitz was asked about if a woman is given by the gas chambers where her child was being taken from her, and she agreed to go with, she wanted to go with her child into the gas chambers because couldn't leave the child alone. And Berkovitz was outraged by the question that they asked, you know, is that according to halacha? Because some things you just do, you don't think about halacha, and a mother is not going to leave a child. I don't think that's similar to what Moshe is implying. I'm going to come back to that story. Thanks for reminding me, because I'm almost done. I have a 3 or 4 part blog post, which I'm almost done. But when I finish with that, I'm going to return to the issue of antinomianism. And I'm going to talk about areas where halacha was violated by great rabbis and other things. And then I'm going to give an example where anyone who's given the choice, including in the most frum community, would willingly violate a halacha, black letter halacha, and not feel bad about it, and no rabbis would feel problematic about it either. Now, I don't want to give you the details now, I don't want to give it away, but this is the halacha, and I've asked people from the more right-wing world, and they agree with me that no one would, that undoubtedly what I'm saying is correct, and everyone would violate this, even though it is an explicit halacha. And I'm going to make the point that there are some cases where antinomianism is really found in the law itself, because the reason for violating the law is this sort of overarching ethos, this overarching value, which says that in this particular case, the law just doesn't work, and the law wasn't intended for this case, even though if you just look at the sources, it should apply in that case. So I know I'm probably being more ambiguous than I should be. But a big, big Talmud Chacham agreed with me absolutely that what I'm saying is correct. And then I'm going to cite a note of Yehuda about this and some other sources. So I'll get back to what Berkovitz said then. Meiselman says the breathing machine is misleading. He's still lucid as 102. And you can see that interview with him. And what I think is significant is that he's wearing his yarmulke in his interview, because all the earlier pictures, even though when he was pious and he wrote his famous book, he didn't walk around wearing a yarmulke. That wasn't part of the scene in America in those days. But you see him now, he's wearing his yarmulke, and very good. Now, Moshe said, you say, I don't think, Moshe says, I don't think Kollel was his invention. Well, look, there already was a Kollel, as I called it. You had it in Kovno, and even in White Plains. What was that if not a Kollel, in a sense? They called it a Beis Medrash, as I recall. But really, it's a Kollel. It's older guys learning. But the concept of a Kollel, where everyone is supposed to learn. You finish yeshiva, you get married, you're supposed to go and devote yourself to learning. That this is an ideal, that is something that he instituted. Whoever had such a concept where what kollel means is that everyone is supposed to sit and learn, not a couple of elite people. Even YU had a kollel where they had elite people who sat and learned because they're going to be Rosh Yeshiva. But I mean kollel in the sense of where everyone is supposed to spend time after you're married learning. Who else had that? So you say that's his own twist, but that's the whole idea of kollel. Otherwise, it's just a Beis Medrash where a few guys are being paid to learn. When we say Kollel today, that's what we mean. Yes, Moshe points out that Konvitz was the Ritbaz's son-in-law. Yaakov Belgorovsky. He was the rabbi in Newark as well, and he wrote a volume of responsa. His son is Milton Konvitz, who's a professor at Cornell. And Milton Konvitz, a very well-known person, he was the one who asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, is it permitted to have an interfaith chapel in Cornell University? If you look at the book that Natty Huff got published, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik's long letter in opposition to the interfaith chapel. And that was asked by Milton Konvitz. Yes, Meisman, there were Americans in the War of Independence, but I don't know if there was actually a terrorist attack where Americans were killed, like walking down the street and someone stabs you or something like that. Chaim M. tells me that Rabbi Eisley was Rosh Yeshiva MTA, rabbi of Young Israel of Astor Gardens in the Bronx. I'm repeating this all because for many of the people who listen on tape, Rabbi Kinnerek is Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva Or HaMeir, Peekskill Yeshiva. Very nice. Thank you for that. I knew a Kinnerek in YU, Arnie Kinnerek. He was in Gross Kollel when I was at BMT, getting SMIF at YU. Maslin, you heard of Shlomo Carbach went to Columbia? I don't know. You also heard that Rabbi Weinberg said this to the Stipler, that when Weinberg of Neir Yisrael told the Stipler that they send kids to Loyola, he won't look at him. Okay. And Ira says, Rav Persky in Milwaukee teaches at Maryknoll University, Catholic. And he's psychology, right? It's not... All I assume is that Rav Aharon, his opposition to college should be the same whether it's Catholic or not. That is, opposed college because they're teaching heretical ideas or because it's Bittul Torah. But to throw in the Catholic angle, it's just from a standpoint of Metzius, it's incorrect. What he describes as taking place. Now, it could be that you have certain Catholic universities, like you have Steubenville. Where's Steubenville? I think in Ohio, I think, which is like an old-fashioned Catholic university, which Catholicism really is part of the spirit of the whole university. But if you go to Fordham or if you go to Boston College, especially if you're in the graduate schools, but if you study sciences or things like that, there's no sense, you know, there's nothing Catholic per se about it. Now, you do have the theology courses. So I would agree that if you don't get an exemption, not all the universities will give you an exemption. I mean, if you have Jewish studies there, you can often get an exemption and take a class in Jewish studies or take something else. But if you couldn't get an exemption and you had to take the Catholic, the course in usually one semester in Catholic theology, the other semester just like in Bible, then I guess there would be a problem. Rav Aharon would be correct that you're being forced to. So unless you want to argue, you know, that there's nothing wrong with studying world religions. And by the way, these Catholics, the courses in theology, at least in Scranton, are not necessarily taught by Catholics. They're taught as academic classes. So you have Protestants teaching, you have an atheist teaching. They're not Sunday school. They're not trying to indoctrinate. They're talking about Catholic ideas. It's no different than reading a book on Vatican II and learning about Catholicism. So that, I don't think there's a lot of problem studying that, but Rav Aharon might think that's a problem also. That I get. But if you're just talking about taking classes there, and you don't have to take that, really, I could say the Metzius is that the Catholic University is no different than the other university. And it could be the Catholic University is better because you don't have the homosexual societies on campuses, you don't have the pro-choice, and they have much more respect for religious people. As Rav Moshe Feinstein, he said that the Catholic University is preferable. Moshe says, Rav Baruch Rabinowitz. I don't know Rav Baruch Rabinowitz to know about his diametrically opposed view to Rav Aharon. I don't know anything about him. Meiselman says that he heard from an old European Rav that American Balabatim think it's rude to disagree with a rabbi, but in Europe, the learned Balabatim always challenge the Rav. Yeah, it's famous that they would always challenge him, and the yeshiva students would challenge him. The legend, and I think it's a legend because I don't think it's true, the legend of Rav Dov Schwartzman. I already spoke about the Rav Aharon's daughter. She married this Rav Dov Schwartzman, and the marriage didn't work because she was open-minded, they say. She went to university. He wasn't. The story that's told as to how he became the shidduch after Rav Gorin didn't work out, and I'll talk about Rav Gorin next class or the class after, is as follows. I don't know if it's true, but this is what it's told. I can't imagine that what I'm going to tell you could have happened, that anyone could have had such lack of kavod for Rosh Yeshiva. But, I mean, it's one thing to argue and to disagree with the Rosh Yeshiva. And if you read the Stanford's book, you see that when people would come, let's say, to give a shiur, the bachrim would prepare to constantly throw akashas so the guy couldn't finish his shiur. That was, but this is the story. Supposedly, Rav Aharon was in Israel giving a shiur. And there was a guy in the back of the base medrash sitting there, you know, shlumpy or with his foot on the table, you know. I can't, that's what they say, foot on the table. I can't imagine that. But whatever, showing that he wasn't taking it seriously. And afterwards, Rav Aharon came up to him and says, you know, Kavod HaTorah, this is how you're sitting. And supposedly, Rav Schwartzman says, when the Rosh Yeshiva can properly explain the Tosfos, then I'll show Kavod HaTorah. And based on that answer, supposedly, Rav Aharon says, I want him. That, you know, here, you know, he's not afraid to give his opinion, and he's a Talmud Chacham. Whether it's true or not, and I don't think it's true, is not important. It's the fact that this story is told to shows you that they were not afraid to object and challenge even Rosh Yeshiva. Yes, Meisman points out that the actual interviews were only published, Heimrich's actual interviews were only published recently. If you can send me Meiselman, I remember seeing that. If you could send me the link where they appear, okay. Many other comments. I don't have time. I want to go through all of them. Ira said, "Remichel Tanai is psychology brother." So, what is Ira? What is Twersky from? You're right. That's not. What is from Milwaukee? What does he teach at that university? Ira also says Yosha Bear encouraged David Hartman to study at Fordham. He did. He encouraged him to study philosophy there. Rav Soloveitchik, the lonely man of faith, was first delivered as a lecture at St. John's Theological Seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts. Yes, you say Rav Aharon didn't approve. Not only did Rav Aharon didn't approve, but he would have seen it as a Avodah Zarah. But Hartman was not with Rav Aharon at that time. Hartman had left Lakewood, and Hartman was studying. And later, when Hartman sort of went off the deep end from the traditional Orthodox perspective, and people came to Rav Soloveitchik and said, Hartman said this and that, the Rav is said to have replied, "Why are you coming to me? He studied, how many years he said he studied with me, but he studied with Rav Aharon before me." So in other words, don't blame me. Blame Rav Aharon if you're going to blame. Don't blame me. It's not my. He started with Rav Aharon too. It's a cute answer, but had he remained in Lakewood, Hartman never would have come to say what he said. There's no question that, you know, by going to Fordham, that opened him up to things. But you can say there's people who came out of Lakewood and Mir and other places who, Moshe Scherer from the Aguda, the head of the Aguda, his brother was a Reform rabbi. Came right out of the yeshiva world. So you can find funny examples of that as well. Meiselman says a different issur is to walk into a church-owned building where services may be held. Church services are only held in the church. That's the only place you hold services in a Catholic university or in a chapel. You don't hold services anywhere else. You're not supposed to do it anywhere else. The Eucharist, that's where it is. In an emergency situation, or if you're on a camping trip or something, you can do it. But generally, that's not done. Okay, I'll just wait for Ira and Meisman. They might be typing something. I asked Ira to tell me where this Twersky Mary Knoll teaches. And after that, I will say goodnight to everyone. Meiselman says, wasn't a Munkacher in Sao Paulo teaching psychology in a Catholic university? Ira, you're saying that the Twersky in Milwaukee teaching in Marino, what does he teach, though? I don't know if the Munkacher was teach if it was a Catholic university where he was teaching. If it was, that's probably the university where he... I think in Brazil, All the universities are probably Catholic. I don't think in those days they had secular universities, but it can be checked out. But it's not just the teaching there. He studied there. He also went to school there. So I'm waiting for Ira to send what Rav Michal teaches in the Catholic University. We've had many very religious people who've taught in Catholic universities. Well, no, you'll have to email me about that. I thank you all for tonight, and we'll meet next class. Good night, everyone.